everybody. This is the Codependent Perfectionist Podcast, and I'm Alana Carvalho. And today I brought back one of our special guests. Her name is Dani Bryant, and we did the episode on perfectionism and body image together. And I got so much great feedback on that podcast that I'm so excited to bring Dani back. And today we're going to be talking about codependency and body image, but also eating disorders. And we're actually doing that because somebody had reached out and said, hey, can you talk more about overeating and codependency? So I reached out to Dani and I said, hey, Dani, what do you think about doing an episode on overeating and codependency? And she said, well, actually, that's not really the right terminology anymore. So Dani, come on in here. Why don't you share a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. So, you know, from my framework as both an eating disorder therapist and someone who works with folks with disordered eating or body image work, we're always trying to find the neutral, right? So it's staying away from the all or nothing, the good or bad. So even over is more a term that tends to swing as if there is a good way of eating or a bad way, that you could be an overeater or an undereater versus trying to find neutrality. And overeating also alludes to this idea that there's like standardization that people should be eating. And therefore, if you go beyond it, it is over. So we're trying to find more of a neutral term. And so I wonder if when this individual is asking the question, if it was more talking around what we might think of binge eating or subjective binge eating, which is eating to the point of past fullness, is a more neutral way to say, as opposed to overeating, which can be a term that comes with a lot of stigma, especially for folks in higher weight bodies or with folks who are struggling with other issues. So always trying to find a neutral word, but we can certainly talk about when we are turning to food to cope or to self-soothe or out of numbness or boredom. Those are all ways that maybe previously referred to as overeating, but we want to talk about in a more nuanced way.
Yeah, and I think that's important, as you know, we've all gotten, I think, more aware of language and how there's a lot of judgment in the language that we use often. So I think that that's an important point. So maybe we could get into that a little bit when it actually becomes like a binge eating issue. What is actually the criteria for that, Dani? Can you help the listeners understand when it would actually be considered more of a clinical diagnosis of that sort?
Yes. So I even think the word binge has really been co-opted by pop culture. You know, we talk about like binging Netflix or sort of eating certain types of foods that maybe a person has a relationship with as being a good or a bad food would feel like a binge. But if we're really talking about a clinical binge, it often happens in secret, in isolation. It's often ritualized, meaning that it's certain foods from certain places, maybe eaten in a certain order. It happens in a way that feels out of control. Sometimes there's a piece of disconnection or disassociation. And it is often the amount of food is greater than what that person, the individual themselves, not people in general, would eat in a normal setting. So it really is on a pendulum of disordered, that feeling of out of control is a really important piece. But sort of eating an extra serving of the Chinese food or having an extra dessert twice in one day or really enjoying the buffet at a party, that's not binge eating. That is sort of normal celebratory folks eating for joy and pleasure and comfort. That's all normal human behavior with food, but because of the diet culture we live in, often gets stigmatized, and that word binge gets put on lots of different lifestyles when really it's more natural, normal human relationship with food.
Yeah, and again, that's a great point, because you're right. The term binge is now such a popular term. We use it all the time. I binge watch a show, you know, rather than I think in what you're describing, which is actually like a clinical diagnosis. which is totally different and pretty serious in nature, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And definitely needs support and treatment. Right. And binge eating disorder or other eating disorders that have binge eating as a part of that experience, whether it's bulimia or anorexia nervosa, binge purge type, they all need a particular type of treatment. And what we do know is that it's never restriction. So often folks who experience binge eating, the thought is, well, I'll just eat less. I'll cut down. I'll have more quote unquote willpower or control, but that never leads to the binge eating, feeling some relief from it. Because what we know is the binge is in response to some type of restriction. Mm-hmm. So often folks who struggle with binge eating, they do skip meals or they do make up, quote, quote, make up for the binge by not eating the next day, but the cycle mm-hmm. continues. It's also if we're restricting a type of food because we've labeled it bad. So I can't have the cookies. I can't have the ice cream. That's restriction. And therefore the person eventually is going to come back to the cookies and the ice cream.
Right.
So it's also making sure to stay away from the thought that to heal the binge eating, we must restrict.
Right. Right. Absolutely. That's a great point. And I think what I really want us to kind of move into really talking about for the audience also is this, is how, you know, you mentioned before that a lot of times food is used as a coping mechanism. And I think, you know, particularly with something like codependency, where there's so, where we're dealing with so many feelings that we're harboring and often not getting support with and really struggling with, that it would make sense that we would, many of us would use food in this way. Could you speak a little bit to that, Dani?
Sure. I think about, and I know you've spoken about the Cartman drama triangle on the podcast before, and there are three different role types or role archetypes, where it's the victim role, using the symbolic role of victim, the symbolic role of persecutor, the symbolic role of rescuer. Mm-hmm. And almost exclusively, when I look at this different symbolic roles with clients doing food and body image work, they always lean into the role of the rescuer. Mm-hmm. So if that individual feels the sense of rescuing, they have the enmeshed boundaries. It's hard to say no. They want to always fix or enable or over-focus on others. They're often not meeting their own needs. And so the function of the disordered eating, the function of the subjective binge eating or turning to food to cope is often because of self-abandonment and really not attending to their own needs and finding soothing or healing or comfort, safety in food often correlates with folks really being in that codependent role.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can absolutely imagine that. I mean, I'm so glad for you to bring up the drama triangle, because I think that it's such an important piece of this work in identifying the role that we tend to gravitate towards on that triangle. And for those of us who are codependents, we tend to gravitate towards the rescuer role, right? Like that's the role we often feel most comfortable in. And we're trying to save other people, as you're talking about. And then oftentimes we don't, because we can't, we're actually powerless to do that. And then we end up in either victim or persecutor.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm wondering, you know, in your work with people who are using food in this way, how do you help them identify what's going on for them in the triangle and moving them out of it?
Mm-hmm. And so I'm also a drama therapist. And so we use the Cartman drama triangle in an embodied way. And so we also, there's a layer of called the circle of transformation, which is extremely drama therapy. And it's trying to shift the role of the rescuer into someone who is collaborative, a connector. So it's actually not abandoning and say, we can't be rescuers anymore, because that's in some ways part of our superpower, our like innate empathy and our ability to and the want and the gift to be able to help and heal. But it's trying to shift from rescue to something that feels more like collaborate or connect. And so if someone's in the connector role, they are able to set boundaries, whether those are physical boundaries, sexual, emotional, intellectual boundaries, spiritual boundaries, without guilt is the key word. How do we set boundaries without guilt? And then also, I wonder if you could speak to this too, Alana, of when someone's rescuing, they're actually taking away the power from someone else to figure it out for themselves.
Yeah.
And so having that reframe too of like, every time I rescue, am I taking away someone else's power to help themselves? And then how do we, you know, treat ourselves with respect and learn how to say no without explanation? Mm. No, period. Mm-hmm. So I think boundaries, which I know you come back to again and again, is always the place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I do speak about exactly what you're talking about often, right? Like the boundaries piece is so essential. And that guilt piece, I actually just spoke about this in the mother-daughter part two podcast that I have put up, which is that oftentimes when we're doing this work, it is likely that we're going to feel that guilt when we're initially putting up the boundaries, because we're so primed to feel that way. And it's so uncomfortable for us to change and put those boundaries in place, that, you know, we actually feel uncomfortable, and we will until we don't. And that might take a lot of time, but it has to take repetition of the behavior for the emotion to catch up to that. But you know, you're absolutely right. Also, I feel strongly that in the rescuer role, we disempower other people. And that's a really negative part of codependency that we don't often focus on as much, because we think we're doing so great by helping other people. And this is a big one that us therapists have to learn about too, because, you know, we oftentimes are codependent. We want to save everybody, especially when we come into the field. And we can get really burnt out very quickly when we realize that we actually can't save people. But not only that, that it's actually to their detriment if we're the ones doing the saving, because they actually need to build up the skills for that. You know, that's the most important piece. We want people to feel like, I can do this on my own, right? I don't need Alana or Danny to be there for me. At first I do, but then eventually I feel strong enough that I can do it myself.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think the piece around the guilt and the shame also really correlates to food and body image work. Mm. So much of really those core beliefs around food and body is around guilt, or feeling guilty after eating something or not eating something, or guilt and shame around one's body size or one's relationship with their body too. So I think when we're setting boundaries without guilt on the outside, it seems like I'm setting boundaries with this person to work on my codependency. But also that will inherently echo out and help someone work on their relationship with food and their body. It's sort of the intersection of, by setting boundaries, we're healing all parts of self, not just, quote unquote, just a piece that on the surface is around time or energy or effort or rescue. I think it can really help someone heal their relationship with food and body as well.
I agree. And I think, you know, I was going to ask you about that, because I believe, and in my work, I work with people with all different types of coping mechanisms, right? Like, it's not just one thing. It's like, it can come out in all sorts of ways, whether it's drugs and alcohol, or it's food, like we're talking about, or it's workaholism, or whatever it is in the way it comes out. But, and people always say to me, like, well, what are the steps like to healing, right? But in many ways, the things we're doing, I mean, it's so intangible to some extent. But what happens is, it, in a sense, it almost doesn't matter what the coping mechanism is, because mm-hmm. I do believe what naturally happens is that as we begin to feel better about ourselves, as we begin to trust ourselves, put those boundaries in place, and form this very different relationship with ourselves than we had before, whatever our coping mechanism is tends to lessen. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's almost like a natural process that people don't even see happening. I'm wondering if you see it that same way, Danny.
Yes. And I also think of those coping mechanisms or those parts of the self, whether it's a disordered eating part or the workaholism part, it thinks it's helping. Like that part of us thinks it's keeping us safe because it right. developed so long ago. Right. So it's also trying to change how we talk to ourselves about whatever we're working on. When some frameworks might be like, go away, I hate you, get away from me. Part of self that wants to soothe with food or other behaviors, that the shift is actually leaning into like radical compassion for that part of ourself, that coping mechanism that thinks it's helping. It developed as a way to protect. And that can also really shift things for folks when we change the way we talk to ourselves from that more harsh inner critic, I have to be mean to myself to help me achieve my goals, when it's really the opposite. The more compassionate we are with ourselves, the more we're able to talk kindly to those wounded parts. That's also where we can see some of these shifts happen naturally.
Absolutely. And that's one of the hardest things, I think, for people working on themselves, is to shift that voice from being so harsh and critical about whatever it is that we are doing to cope, to that compassionate voice that you're talking about. It's so, so hard. I mean, it's so ingrained. We've had it for so many years, and making that shift takes a lot of effort. And people think I'm crazy when I present that to them, but it's really an essential part, I believe, of that healing process, is to have that compassion for ourselves, that whatever it is that we're doing, you know, it's really human in so many ways. All of us are doing it. It might just look differently. And yes, some of the ways we cope look nicer on the outside than others, right? Like workaholism might look nicer than some of the other ways we cope, like drugs and alcohol, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily better, right? It's really just, it's all, in a sense, it's just all coping mechanisms, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just about us finding that way to say, yeah, this is the way I do it. And maybe that's because it's the way my family did it, or that's just the way that I learned at an early age to help myself feel better. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love, do you know Kristen Neff's work on self-compassion? And she breaks it down into like three different categories, because sometimes self-compassion is also one of those ambiguous words that we don't really know what it means. But she breaks self-compassion down into self-kindness, so how we talk to ourselves internally or externally. Mindfulness, so how we slow down, how we pause, how we have space. And common humanity is a huge part of self-compassion, because once we realize that we, as you just said, we are not alone in our own coping mechanism, because it presents in so many different ways, that can actually open up into a different level of self-compassion when we remember just how much of the world and human and our humanness struggles with these coping skills that we're trying to work on.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's great. So well said that way. I'm wondering, Danny, for people who are listening, who are using food as their primary coping mechanism, what are your thoughts in terms of what they can do more specifically in terms of working through this issue?
And you and I are using coping mechanism in sort of a general term. So it is, the first step is to figure out what the function of the eating or the restriction or the compensatory behavior or the negative body image thoughts are. So trying to slow things down and say, I developed this for a reason. It thinks it's helping. What is it helping me with? Is it helping me numb? Is it helping me not feel a feeling? Is it distracting me? Is it a type of self-punishment? Is it a way for me to give myself a unique identity in the world? Is it a way to rebel against the rescuer role and to say, no, I'm going to take up space in this way? So I think that's a great first step, and often can be done via journaling with your therapist, in community. So there's a huge community of folks also doing this work on Instagram, lots of groups that can be found. I can also send you some of those resources too, Alana, to post. And so I think it is around, the first step is figuring out What is it helping me with?
Yeah, I think that's great. And, you know, I think that you're right. There's so many great resources out there right now. So for those of you listening, if this is something that resonates for you in any way, don't hesitate to reach out to either of us to get support around it and to get some of those resources, many of which are free, which is really lovely. Mm-hmm. So Dani, could you share with the audience where they can find you?
Sure. So you can find me via our website, the Intuitive Healing website, or my website is DaniBryant.com. So just my name.com, and you can reach out and connect with me there. And I also have some resources on my website as well.
And as Dani mentioned, she's one of our wonderful therapists who works at Intuitive Healing. And you can find out more about Intuitive Healing by going to the website, which is intuitivehealingnyc.com. And don't forget that you can find me on Instagram or my website at The Codependent Perfectionist. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And thank you, Dani, for being here.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day.